Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Ray Lehman. He's a senior fellow at R Street, and he's also the co-founder of R Street, which is a public policy think tank that talks about environmental and other kinds of policy issues. Ray Lehman, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're talking about Hurricane Harvey, which has slammed Houston and is actually taking on other parts of the Gulf Coast right now. One of the things that we're hearing a lot, and this has certainly got to be the most politicized hurricane, you know, in history, even more than Katrina, as it's unfolding. But we're hearing that Hurricane Harvey, and especially the damage in Houston, is evidence of climate change. The LA Times, this is a representative headline. Where in a House editorial, they said Harvey should be a warning to Trump that climate change is a global threat. Is that the right way to be talking about Hurricane Harvey and especially the damage in Houston?
It's not that. Obviously, we believe climate change is a global threat. Whether any particular storm can be attributed to climate change is that's more controversial. It's not entirely clear that climate change in and of itself would change hurricane patterns in this way. There's various impacts that climate change could have on hurricanes. Sort of general consensus is that warmer sea temperatures will drive more powerful storms. There's mixed opinion on whether they will cause more frequent storms. And there's pretty much consensus, at least in the Atlantic Basin, that the long-term effects of climate change would actually be to make fewer storms make U.S. landfall, because the trade winds are going to be weakening. So fewer storms are going to get that northeast lift, take them off the Caribbean and into the United States. Unfortunately, that means they'll mostly be hitting Latin America, where they don't have the same resources we do to recover. So what you can say, yeah, that's a problem. What you can say for sure is that sea level rise is a threat. That has already happened, and there are other causes of sea level rise beyond just climate change, all of which contribute both in this storm and in flood risks more generally.
What are the other causes of sea level change? Because I'm working at this from a layman's perspective, but I mean like Reason believes that climate change is happening, that temperatures are warming, and that human activity has at least something to do with that. But then if it's not just the polar ice caps melting and whatnot, what's causing sea level rise?
If you go down to southern Louisiana, it is erosion, soil erosion in general, or land, what you would call land subsidence, which is the land falling as much as the sea rising. So that's happening in a number of areas, including here. I live in Florida, that's happening even without change in the absolute level of the sea. In Louisiana, actually one of the major not major, but contributing causes is the nutria rat eating away at a bunch of vegetation, and that causing greater erosion. So there are definitely other causes besides just climate change that are relevant in these contexts.
So is there, to go back to this question of the effects of climate change on the number and intensity of storms, is there yet, I mean, there's a lot of theory out there, but is there yet evidence that, because you also hear this, that, get used to this, there are going to be more hurricanes, there are going to be more big storms,
right,
and they're going to be more intense. And you're saying the evidence on that is a little bit mixed or ambivalent right now.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we just came off a dozen years without a major hurricane making landfall in the United States. There had not been one since 2005. Sandy was a very large storm, but it wasn't even a hurricane when it made landfall. It was a tropical storm, just a physically enormous one. You had Hurricane Ike, and that was a 2, and last year you had a couple ones, but there hadn't been a 3 or larger is a major hurricane.
Mm-hmm. But each big storm, and I guess whether it's a tropical storm or a hurricane and what category of hurricane varies, but it seems that each big storm sets damage records, and that's often kind mm-hmm. of, that kind of gets equated with, well, the storms are more powerful, they're more dangerous. But is the damage record, is that mostly because more people are living near near places like are living on the coasts or in areas that are at risk? Or, you know, so is it really a weather problem or is it a kind of a location and demographic problem?
It's primarily a people problem. As I mentioned, I live in Florida. It is a low-lying peninsula that jets out into the most hurricane-prone region in the world. If you go back to the World War II, Florida was the smallest, least populated state in the South, and it is now the third largest state in the country. Now, more than half the U.S. population now lives in coastal counties. That was up about 45% over the decades from like 1970 to 2010. In fact, there's a great journal piece in Nature back in 2013, and they projected the global flood losses would by 2050 rise to about $60 billion. So that's about 10 times what they have been, which is about $6 billion. But if there was no, if you did not include the impacts of climate change or sea level rise at all, it would still be expected to rise to about $50 billion just from economic development and growth in coastal populations.
Well, and Houston is like that. In 1950, Houston only had about 600,000 people, I think, something like that. And it's now got about 2.3 million people. It's nipping at the heels of Chicago to become the third largest city in the country. And then the metro area itself or the larger county is big as well. You know, so it's clear that like if a hurricane hits, a big storm hits in Houston now, it's going to affect magnitudes of order more people than it would have 50 years ago or 40 years ago, property. Other things that I've read that say that attribute to the ferocity of the storm there, though, is that the amount of pavement and developed surfaces around Houston is just gigantic because the more people you have, the more roads you have, the more houses you have, the more buildings. Is that, you know, and that all makes it harder for water to dissipate. Is that, you know, is that sort of development a contributing factor to the effects of these storms?
You can't say it's not a contributing factor. I mean, it's certainly beyond just the fact that there are more people, more surface area, making it more difficult for groundwater to be absorbed is definitely contributes to the size of the flood. You know, the thing that people have been bringing up specifically is noting that Houston doesn't have zoning, right? But zoning, if you look nationwide, the actual impact of zoning tends to be to fight dense housing as opposed to encouraging it. Like if everyone in Houston lived in the kinds of high rises they live in San Francisco or New York City or Chicago, then theoretically you could have that same size city with less covered space, more open land. But you can't assume that that's what a zoning board in Houston would do, right? That's not how zoning boards usually act. People don't like density. And when you give governments power to control land use like that, they usually act in the opposite direction, which is where the politics are. So, I mean, I think what you can say is that, like, there are probably flood mitigation measures that they could still take. I know there are two major reservoirs that date back to, like, the 40s, and they've held up pretty well given the intensity of this storm, but they probably could use some updating. The Army Corps might want to look at that. And when it comes to, like, stormwater runoff, the market on its own may not be pricing the externality of that appropriately. There's actually an interesting system in D.C. In D.C. itself, they have something like a cap-and-trade system for stormwater, where if you're downtown and it's really expensive to treat stormwater runoff, you can buy credits from people, you know, up in Cleveland Park or whatever to get your share of the runoff through their properties. And that's a thing, you know, either like a tax on total paving or that sort of thing that might be a way to move it in a more flood-friendly direction. But I don't think you can say it's zoning or development yeah. in and of itself.
Well, and you know, zoning, it's as Houston climbs the list of like the most populated cities, the most popular cities in the country, zoning keeps coming up. You know, that's why it's so ugly. That's why it has no character. That's why it has flooding. You know, and it's odd for a city that is almost universally rebuked by, you know, kind of zoning czars and land use planners and aesthetic, you know, kind of architects. It seems to be quite popular. Popular enough that more people keep moving there. So it's strange. And yeah, the whole notion that zoning somehow is, you know, the thing that separates us from the animals is kind of bizarre, to say the least.
Right.
You know, you have talked about that, you know, right near Houston, and actually in this storm, there is an alternative to a story that's not really being talked a lot about that has to do with Port Aransas. Tell me about what is going on there and why that kind of is a counterexample of how we might seriously mitigate the effects of extreme weather.
Right. So one thing that's interesting about this is that it's not actually the case that you should conceive of the damage we're going to see from Harvey as primarily hurricane damage, because it sat over Houston for all these days as a tropical storm or even a subtropical storm. So all the flooding was not done by a hurricane. It was done by just a massive and unprecedented amount of water. It was a hurricane when it landed. It was a Category 4. There's only been a few Category 4s we've ever had. It landed near Port Aransas, which is just north of Corpus Christi. And you certainly saw
and
damage
Corpus,
down there.
Corpus
right?
Christi is a few hours south down the Gulf of Mexico
right, yeah.
coast from
yeah.
From Galveston and Houston.
From Houston. Yeah. Right, exactly. You definitely saw damage there. We're going to, you know, the insurance modeling firms that do this kind of thing expect about $2 billion in wind damages there. But for a Category 4 storm hitting, you know, a coastal region, that's actually remarkably low. And the reason it's remarkably low is there's not much development there. And there's a good reason there's not much development there, which is that area is part of what's called the Coastal Barrier Resources System, which was set up in the early 80s. It was a Republican proposal. It came from John Chafee of Rhode Island. It was signed by President Reagan. And what the Coastal Barrier Resources Act does is any land within this zone of 273 million acres, if you put them together, they'd be like the third largest national park in the country. Any development in that area, you're free as a private citizen to invest your own money. What you can't get is federal subsidies. There's no federal highways. There's no federal public housing. You're not eligible for flood insurance in this zone of barrier islands and coastal wetlands that were undeveloped as of the early 80s. And they've mostly stayed underdeveloped because developers don't want to do it. They don't want to invest if they can't get the subsidies. And that's pretty key to our resilience from these sorts of storms, because barrier islands serve the purpose of being a buffer. They absorb a lot of water. They can flood. They can be underwater for some period of time. We saw in places where barrier islands are developed, say the Jersey Shore in Hurricane Sandy, you know, the difference between they're right next to each other, but Island Beach State Park and Seaside Heights. Seaside Heights is just north of Island Beach State Park. Island Beach State Park is part of the Coastal Barrier Resources System. It serves its function of absorbing water. Seaside Heights is where Snooki goes, and it served its function of getting knocked to hell once Sandy came through.
Well, yeah, it's funny when you talked about the shift towards people living in coastal counties and whatnot. I, like you, grew up in New Jersey a painful number of years ago, but I can remember even in the 70s where I grew up in Monmouth County by Sandy Hook, which is the first ocean beach. You know, it's about 30 miles or 35 miles north of Seaside Heights. And, you know, I always felt kind of bad for, I mean, it was common, like the people who live by the beach tended to have lower income jobs. They were blue collar workers. I mean, it was kind of a hard scrabble existence. And within, you know, 10, 20 years, all of a sudden, you know, everybody wanted to live on the beach. And similar in California, even I lived in L.A. and Santa Monica during the course of the late 60s and 70s, went from a kind of sleepy working class town to a playpen for, you know, Hollywood royalty. Is, you know, how much did federal policy or state policies kind of change to make the kind of beach or the shore more attractive for people to live there? I mean, was it that they, you know, a bunch of policies went into place that helped soak up all of these high costs that people wouldn't really be able to, wouldn't be willing to pay out of pocket?
So in 1968, we created the National Flood Insurance Program. Prior to that, there really wasn't very much insurance coverage for floods. There had been some market in like the late 19th century and early 20th century. There was a series of Mississippi River floods in like the 20s that kind of ended that. And after that, it became very difficult to get insurance coverage for floods. Some of that is things that are sort of accidents of the history of the insurance market in the United States. It's always been state regulated. And so historically, most insurance companies were local. We didn't have the national companies that you do now back then. And so local companies would face extreme, unlike a fire, which is a fortuitous thing, it tends to only affect one property at a time, maybe two or three if the major blaze, a flood can destroy an entire city. So insurance companies that were local didn't want to be exposed like that. The reinsurance market, which is insurance for insurance companies, wasn't yet as developed as it is now. And so you didn't have very much private flood insurance. In the 60s, we created the National Flood Insurance Program, which extended underpriced flood insurance offered by the federal government to pretty much everyone. It's any community that wanted to participate and met certain basic standards. The original idea was that it was going to encourage communities to invest in flood mitigation. I think it did a little bit of that early on, but it has not really served that purpose in the long run. It served the purpose of making it possible to live in places people never lived before, because now you have a mechanism to bail you out once things go wrong. The state of Florida, for sure, was built on the National Flood Insurance Program. It's about one-third of National Flood Insurance Program policies are here in Florida.
Wow. And, you know, is there any movement to restrict that or to peel it back? I mean, it sounds like farm subsidies in a way where, you know, and it's obviously it's not the only reason people flock to the water. You know, it's also true that, you know, construction methods get better. Yeah, you know, people like the water and the weather and all of that, but it's a contributing factor, and it's certainly one that's under our control. Is there any sense that, you know, these are policies that can't stand, and why the hell are people who live in either parched areas of the country or places not prone to flooding are bailing out, you know, people who tend to be wealthier living on Long Island, living on the Jersey Shore, living in Florida?
So back in 2012, we had a bill called the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act that passed and was signed by President Obama. And Biggert Waters took those policies that were not paying appropriate rates and put them on a path to gradually see their rates increase. Then just about immediately after that bill passed, you started getting scare stories that were distributed with the help of FEMA by not responding to them, served the interest of home builders and realtors who did not like that this was going to have an impact on housing markets. And people were told that their rates might increase to $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. There was no evidence of this. Just none at all, but FEMA did not really do anything to provide clarity. And in the middle of that hysteria, we then got a second bill in 2014 called the Grim Waters Act, which is, I think, appropriately named. Also appropriate that Maxine Waters, who co-sponsored the original bill, was then on the second bill that largely repealed the Biggert Waters Act, or at least it slowed it down enormously. And that was unfortunate. Now, it's still the case that over the long term, these properties are seeing rate increases. They're pretty modest, and we will get to a point eventually where they're paying what they should. And there's also encouraging signs that we're getting a private flood insurance market. It's still new. It's not very large. It's not yet enough to take over completely, but it's building, and we'll get there. There is legislation right now. You know, the flood insurance program's authorization expires at the end of September. There's legislation right now that passed through the House Financial Services Committee a couple months ago that would help with some of the key questions on private flood insurance, like if you have a mortgage, does the private flood insurance count? What kind of private flood insurance do you need that would be equivalent to the NFIP? There's also rules like currently the NFIP policies are sold by private insurance agents who are usually affiliated with insurance companies. If you are an insurance company that takes part in that what's called the Write Your Own program, then you are not permitted to write private flood insurance. So that's another rule that would change in the House bill. And also just like getting the data available from FEMA to the private market about flood losses and underwriting. All of that, I think, we will push forward towards a more robust private market that will hopefully more appropriately price.
Right. And the goal of that is just that, you know, to the extent that insurance is seen or is a risk management tool, we'll get a fairer pricing of the costs and benefits of living in, you know, in areas that are prone to extreme weather.
And if that happens, then there are projects that might otherwise take place if they're subsidized by the government that won't take place, as you see in the Coastal Barrier Resources System. Because if you have to pay your full freight, if you have to take account of what the real risks are, then you're going to adjust your, at the margin, you're going to adjust your behavior, which doesn't mean no one lives at the coast. That's sort of how the command and control environmental movement would approach this. There are efficient ways to live at the coast. There are efficient losses to take. But at the same time, we don't want this to be on the backs of taxpayers.
So what are some other policies that would mitigate, you know, that and, you know, kind of mitigate the effects of, you know, say, of hurricanes, of extreme weather, of floods that, you know, that we should be pursuing and that we should be talking about rather than, you know, arguing over whether or not Melania Trump should have worn stilettos or sneakers, you know, when she was leaving
right.
to visit Houston?
So like Shakespeare said, first kill all the lawyers. I say first kill all the subsidies. Then we can move on to stage two. Libertarians will differ on the degree to which they think a lot of things are government responsibilities. I'm more or less okay with things like levees and other public construction. I'd like to see more things done at the local level where it can be more responsive, but I think that those are appropriate infrastructure projects to help protect communities. I think you can have some degree of land use planning where things like, for instance, if you have a repetitive loss property and the government's going to buy it out and move this person somewhere else, say, okay, you've flooded too much, or you've suffered whatever sort of disaster too frequently, we're going to buy you out and move you somewhere else, then maybe you don't allow people to build there anymore once that money has been spent. Otherwise, you're sort of creating an incentive to just keep moving in and then taking the buyout.
Does that happen frequently? I seem to recall somewhat dimly stories about like whole towns on the Mississippi kind of getting bought out or people being relocated.
There are two programs within FEMA. One is within the flood insurance program, and one is just disaster mitigation in general that do have authority to do buyouts. In the National Flood Insurance Program, it was back in 2004, Congress passed this bill, Jim Bunning and Earl Blumenauer were two of the sponsors, the intent was that if you had three losses, then you would be bought out. You would either have to raise your home or be bought out. But I don't think they ever funded it. And so lacking any funding, it never really happened. There's a limited number of buyouts that happen through FEMA, but it's not terribly much.
What about on and I'm thinking three, and especially Jim Bunning, a Hall of Fame baseball pitcher, you would think it'd be three strikes and you're out, like you get nothing. You are now officially owned by the government or something.
Of That's course, bizarre. That was the name of the bill.
I see. Three strikes.
And you are out of the National Flood Insurance Program.
I thought it was like three strikes and we bring out the tee and you just keep hitting until you get until you get on base. But what about on a global level? What are your preferred ways to deal with climate change? Because it seems to me there are within the broader libertarian community or the broadly defined libertarian community, there are some people who still say, global warming isn't happening or, it happens all the time and we have nothing to do with it. And so, why talk about it at all? Most people I know who are libertarians say, climate change is happening. It's observable. Human activity is contributing to it. And then, what do you do next? And one of the things that I find very attractive is the idea that, if we go with like a massive global program that slows down economic innovation and economic activity, suddenly instead of living in South Florida, we're living in Bangladesh, and we have fewer resources to kind of be resilient and to build better buildings and come back from weather events. Is that kind of your approach to global warming, or what are the ways that we should deal with climate change, as a planet?
What we certainly agree with is we think the greatest response to climate change is to be wealthy and to have the resources to be able to deal with the effects, which are still largely unknown, right? You can't know what you're going to need to do, but having more money always helps. We also, we're not, this is not a secret, we support a carbon tax, one that does not in any way raise taxes. In fact, we have proposed replacing the corporate income tax entirely with a carbon tax. Carbon tax, we will fully admit, does not actually reverse global warming. It may help at the margin, but it is unlikely to mean that we have no effects. We're going to have effects that we're going to have to deal with. But if you do it in the right way, if you deregulate, you use this to get rid of the existing regulatory structure and to zero out a tax that is more destructive to capital, we think that you can still grow and still be prosperous and at the margin, control some of the worst effects.
So in our streets kind of plan for slowing carbon emissions, it would be, you tax everybody who is emitting carbon. You raise the price of carbon, so you get less of it. That's the plan. And then what? But do you earmark that? The purpose of the tax then is to shut down carbon emissions or to lower that in the hope or in the idea that it will on some level help mitigate climate change. What happens to that money? Does that just go into a general revenue stream, or does it get earmarked, or does it? What happens?
There's a lot of proposals that have come forward by a lot of different people. Al Gore wants to use it to offset the payroll tax. There's others who come up with what they call a tax and dividend system, which essentially means you apply the tax and then you give it back to people, presumably based on their income. We have proposed using it to replace the corporate income tax. And what we think is an advantage of that is replacing the corporate income tax actually raises some money in and of itself. If you just repealed it because of how inefficient it is. And so that helps take care of some of the problem, because if you got rid of the corporate income tax, then a good portion of that income would instead be earned by corporate CEOs or shareholders through dividends and through capital gains. And you could capture the money that way at the individual level. I think it's always going to be the case that corporations will have more lobbying power than people. And so anytime you create a new corporate tax, anytime you try tax reform, it does not take very long for that to get mucked up with all sorts of exemptions and special treatment. Get rid of the corporate tax. Use this tax instead.
How do you levy a carbon tax? Like how do you identify the sources and then say, okay, you owe, you know, this much, you owe that much.
Right. So generally you want to do it as close to the source as possible at the level of either, say, the refiner if you're talking about motor fuels, or at the level of, you know, the generator if you're talking about electricity. There are other sources of carbon, other sources of greenhouse gases. Smarter people than I could tell you the most efficient way to deal with them, but that's the broad strokes of it.
But essentially, it would be like putting a meter on devices that produce carbon. So, you know, it's kind of like an electric meter, something, or a gas meter, something like that.
Right. Yeah. And you want it as far from the consumer as possible. You don't want it to be like at the pump, the way a gas tax is, because the further down the stream it is, first of all, the more chances that it's going to get multiplied. And also that you change behavior in ways that are inefficient.
Do you worry at all it almost sounds the way you're talking about it, that you see the carbon tax as almost a way of buying off environmentalists, especially if it's not going to have a profound impact. It's more like, okay, here's a way that we can shut them up for a while and get rid of the capital or the corporate tax, which virtually even a lot of progressive economists will say is almost completely a stupid tax. It doesn't raise as much money as it should because of lobbying power, and it just gets in the way of business development.
I think that's not unfair as a characterization. If you go back to the Waxman-Markey bill, the cap and trade bill, they wanted to do the same thing. It was just with their own priorities. They wanted to use cap and trade to raise some money, you know, spend it on solar projects and other things that were important to their base and their donors. The climate change was the issue, but cap and trade was the mechanism to get other things they wanted done. Well, there's other things we want done, and we think we can use this to get those things done.
All right. Well, as long as we're keeping dry, as a last question, we have had at least each of the previous two presidents, George Bush with Katrina, which was, you know, his response. And he certainly was not the only major political figure in, you know, going back to the governor of Louisiana as well as the mayor of New Orleans. They all handled Katrina very poorly. Barack Obama, you know, it's not clear to me, I think, or a lot of people, whether or not Sandy was his finest hour, but also the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, where he talked about he was going to go looking for asses to kick in his administration because the federal response was terrible to it. What's the essential thing? And it's not to, you know, what does Donald Trump as president need to do to kind of break the chain of, you know, kind of bad responses to major, you know, breaking kind of environmental events?
So I'd say with one thing you notice with certainly with George W. Bush and that is an issue now with Donald Trump, is that at the time of the storm, they were already fairly unpopular. So I think from a political perspective, the first thing you should do is no harm. Donald Trump would help himself to show more empathy than he has. But otherwise, he has a pretty good FEMA director, which is something that you could not have said. It's probably of anybody since James Lee Witt with Clinton. Craig Fugate under Obama was also quite competent, but it is pretty common for the FEMA director to be some political hack. Director Brock under Trump is a guy who has experience from FEMA, has experience as Alabama's manager during the oil spill. And Texas, I'd say more than Louisiana, has competent state government, and they are going to be able to respond more competently. So Trump should mostly stay out of the way, but rather than being weatherman and bragging about the size of the storm, I think he'd do himself some favors to try to show that he's a human being who actually is concerned about other human beings.
So that may be his toughest challenge yet.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank Ray Lehman. He's a senior fellow at R Street, where you can check out rstreet.org. He's also a co-founder. Ray, thanks for talking to us about Houston and the causes and best responses to massive flooding in the Gulf of Mexico.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.